Welcome to the wonderful world of garbage. My name is Terrell Chang. I'm a solid waste engineer by vocation and I guess avocation, and a mechanical engineer by training. This is in fact Garbology 101. And what I'd like to do is get dressed and talk about a few of the myths about solid waste. First, what I'd like to start out with is some of the names that we call this stuff. Think about some of the synonyms like rubbish, refuse, trash, solid waste, junk, antiques, garage sale material. My wife says it's the stuff on your side of the bed there on the floor. So as we say, it all in how you look at it. I'd like to start out with just, this will be the last formal part of my talk, by the way. Just a very rudimentary model of where all this stuff comes from. Basically, we have manufacturers. They make products, and we as consumers buy them and use them up. Manufacturers, of course, don't use 100% of all the raw materials that come in. There is some waste. And as consumers, we don't use up the packaging. We don't usually eat the boxes, that sort of thing. And so we also create some waste. There's also waste created when the products are used up, and they don't fulfill the purpose any longer. Well, that waste then is transferred. That means picked up and hauled somewhere. And in general now, we have three general places where it can go. One is to, well, the traditional way is directly to a landfill. Another way is to a material recovery facility, known in the trade as a MRF, or a recycling center, is another name for it. This is what we call recycling in general. Also send it to an energy recovery facility, also known as a burn plant or an incinerator, and that's a dirty word in states like Indiana. But in general, that's how we handle solid waste in this country. Now, I'd like to explore and maybe explode some myths about solid waste. Myth number one, there's a landfill crisis out there. We're running out of landfill space. Now, you've probably heard some numbers tossed around that large number of landfills, 500 or 1,000 or some number. We've closed this many landfills since some year like 1970 or 1980. Or a third of our landfills will be closed by the year 2000. What would your reaction be if I said instead, by the year 2000, you know, 70% of the cars on the road today will be gone? My God, we've got a shortage of cars. Well, as Jay Leno would say, dump all you want, we'll build more landfills, right? Landfills are something that you can build more of. Cars have a limited lifetime, and so do landfills. The way we do landfill design now, and of course, you know, in the old days they weren't designed, there was a hole in the ground, a rock quarry, and people threw garbage in it until it was filled up. But we do, in fact, today make an attempt to actually design landfills in accordance with engineering and geology principles. And they have typically a 20-year lifetime. Well, how do we pick 20 years? First of all, it allows the person that takes all the risk and expense of developing a landfill, going through the siting process and getting the permits and then building and operating it, gives that person or company or whatever a chance to get some return on their investment. It also complies with tax laws, which, you know, obviously we do things because of tax laws. And frankly, it also outlasts most political careers, which makes it a good kind of thing to do. The fact that many landfills in this country will be closing in the near future doesn't mean that there's a shortage of landfill space. In my estimation, there is in fact no shortage of land that's suitable for landfilling, whether we measure suitability by engineering principles or nearness to population centers or areas where there's low amount of rainfall. There is no shortage of sites like that. And in fact, I believe we have an artificially, politically created shortage of landfills. Now, everybody these days has heard the term NIMBY, not in my backyard. You probably don't know about NIMBY's evil twin, PIPI. PIPI means put it in their backyard. You might not know about NIMTOF, not in my term of office. That's always a good excuse for not citing a facility. But I think an acronym that needs to be part of everybody's vocabulary. I got this from one of the New York State regulators, is BANANA. Build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone. Myth number two. I'm doing my part for recycling when I put out a few bins of newspaper or glass or tin cans or aluminum cans out on the curb once a week. Wrong. This isn't recycling. Remember that this is a very important politically correct symbol these days. So put it on all your personal stationery. This little thing with the arrows. Hopefully you can see it. The triangle. And most of us are thinking that recycling is this piece. Why put it out on the curb? There's two other important pieces. Somebody picks it up, processes it, cleans it up, sells it to somebody else who in turn makes a product that somebody out there wants to buy. Recycling doesn't happen with only this piece here when you put it out on the curb. Unfortunately, that's not a part of recycling that's been emphasized, creating markets for things. You probably have noticed the recent fad where things are, in tiny print, it says recyclable. Well, most everything, this is recyclable. It doesn't mean it's made out of recycled materials. It means that if you go through a lot of time and trouble, you can recycle it. Well, I guess I'm in some sense suggesting that we need to be a little more careful about tossing around these words without really knowing what they mean. Markets are a very important part of making recycling work. They're the only thing that makes recycling work in the long run. Somebody has to buy that material in some fashion later on. An important case in point was a few years ago, people on the East Coast got very excited about recycling newspaper, and they set it on the curb, and garbage companies, haulers, charged people a lot of money to pick that stuff up, and they took it to MRFs, and they cleaned up the newspaper, put it in bales, and they couldn't sell it. It wasn't worth anything then. So they put it in warehouses, and it sat around until somebody said, gee, you know, that's probably going to be a fire hazard. And they said, oh, you're right. And they paid somebody else to haul it out to a landfill because there was no market to take that old newspaper. And so, that's an issue we need to start thinking about and emphasizing, and possibly in our buying habits, look for things that are made out of recycled products. Myth number three. If everybody recycled, we wouldn't need any more landfills. I say give it the old chicken wrapper test. You know, you buy a package of chicken from the store, throw that clear plastic wrap in the garbage after you're done, take it out a day or two later. Would you buy a product made out of that thing? There are limits to what we can recycle. For instance, and this may be something that we don't think about, if you break a dish, drop a plate or a dish on the floor and you scrape up those pieces, those are not recyclable with today's technology. If you threw it in with the glass, the glass bottles that you might be recycling, that could cause that load of glass to be rejected by the recycling market because it's not something we can recycle at this day and age. Think of spark plugs. What do you do with an old spark plug? Can't pull the metal out of it, take the ceramic out of it, and do something with it. So I guess my advice would be there's no such thing as 100% recycling. You always need a landfill, and don't buy a used car from somebody that tells you that you don't need a landfill anymore. You always need one. Myth number four, if I recycle, I'm saving scarce resources. Now, most geologists will tell you that silica sand, which is the basic ingredient in glass, is one of the most abundant materials in the Earth's crust. What about aluminum? It's made from an ore called bauxite. Now that's a pretty common material as well. We just don't happen to have much of it in this country. But it's not scarce by any means. We look at paper. We know it comes from trees. But trees are a renewable resource that can be grown again. I think it's important to think about what we're doing in order to recycle things, especially if they're not so scarce. For instance, let's talk about this transfer or collection step. It's become very popular in this country for states to pass laws that mandate two things. One is called source separation. That means you and I at our homes separate the newspapers, the glass, aluminum cans, and put it into plastic bins or bags or something. and set that out on the curb. We also set out our garbage, maybe on a different day, in a large tote or can or something like that. And so in a lot of places, two trucks come down the street, sometimes on the same day, sometimes on different days. They both use fuel, of course, and one of them is pretty heavy because it's still full of your food waste and things that you can't recycle. And the other one's not very heavy because it's full of all these fluffy materials like plastic soda pop bottles and that sort of thing. And I guess I would call your attention to the fact that we're using almost twice as much diesel fuel to drive this stuff around, stuff that we may or may not be able to sell when we're done with it. And of course, those vehicles are making more air pollution than a single truck would. That's something we need to consider in our effort to save energy or scarce materials. We do save some energy, and I'll grant you this, that if we use recycled glass cullet, broken glass, it does require less glass to make final glass bottles than if you started from sand. The same thing with aluminum cans and with steel. There's no question that you save some energy. But the thing that's often missing when you hear about people talking about how great recycling is the energy used in this extra collection step. Myth number six, let's look at cities like Seattle. Gee, they're doing a lot with recycling. But there's one thing they don't always tell you about Seattle. One of the reasons Seattle is able to do so much in recycling, it has a very, very low-cost landfill. It's called the Columbia Ridge Landfill, and it's in eastern Oregon. And I'm not opposed to that. In fact, I was one of the people that helped them get this, what we call a long haul. They're hauling the garbage by rail to eastern Oregon to get that in place, because I actually believe that there's some good reasons for doing that. But the situation with Seattle is sort of like, gee, it's a lot easier to be philanthropic and if you're rich. So much easier to spend money on recycling when you've got a very cheap long-term landfill. Unfortunately, most large cities in this country don't have that luxury. And so we need to be careful when we hear shining examples of cities that are doing great things in recycling. We need to question the data a little and ask, well, how are they able to do that? Myth number seven, every state or substitute city or county should take care of its own garbage. I only want my own state, city, county garbage in our landfill. I guess I would ask the question, was your car built in your city? Was it built in Detroit or Ohio? Did you buy some bread today? Was that baked in this state? Or where'd the wheat come from? You wearing clothes that are made of cotton grown in this state? We all buy things and they come from other places, and most times they come in packages. And so when we say we don't want to import waste from somewhere, to say, wait a minute, gee, I bought that thing and it came in a package or a box or something. I imported that waste myself. I think we need to stop being so parochial, as if their garbage is their problem. No, it's all of our problem. We need to be thinking a little more globally about waste disposal. We're not living here by ourselves. The state border is not very well marked for a lot of things, and it's not like it's them people over there. Well, is there anybody here I haven't offended yet? it really isn't easy being an iconoclast about being someone who is talking not nice things about recycling, which is next to mom and apple pie and cleanliness and godliness right now. Don't get me wrong, I'm not against recycling, not at all. I think it's something we need to do, but I'm suggesting that we should have maybe better reasons, or at least think about the reasons why we're recycling. We shouldn't be doing it because we think it saves money, because it may very well not save money. Collection is a very expensive thing, picking up, as I said, a second truck full of stuff. We may or may not be saving scarce resources. It depends on what the material is. Let me suggest that instead we recycle because we're called by God, our Creator God, to be good stewards of the creation that we've been given. Someone at a recent science committee meeting said, "Today's solutions are tomorrow's problems." At first I thought, well, that's because I was a scientist, it wasn't an engineer saying that. But I thought about it, and I said, why is it? Why is it that we can't do it right the first time? Is it because technology is inherently bad? Is it because we've misapplied technology? Or maybe it's because we have a lot of trouble discerning what good is, what the right thing is. I'd like to call your attention to a document I'm sure you've all read. It's called The Church and Society, A Lutheran Perspective. It's actually an excellent document for discussion. We've been using it at Spirit of Christ in Novi, Michigan. And we go through it a couple paragraphs a week, and it's amazing. It's a very academic sort of document, but it's amazing how we can find ways to apply it to our lives. If I can read a few quotes from it to kind of try and address this problem of why we have so much trouble figuring out what the right thing is and how to do it. First, and I quote, "Christians have a responsibility to work for justice and peace and to care for the environment. It's an ambiguous world. What is right, good, fitting, or responsible? Dilemmas and obligations of moral life." That's partly why we have trouble. How can we see then, or discern, or search out what is good for the environment? The common good is arrived at through inquiry and deliberation. Sometimes I substitute the word injury, because a lot of us have to learn the hard way, it seems. Again, I quote, "A diversity of persons who know what they believe, but who are open to being transformed by positions different from their own, need to participate in that deliberation." I think in places like Holden, maybe in 1,000 congregations at adult Bible studies or adult coffee hours or something, maybe that's a good place to start. Well, why do we really have such a hard time figuring out solutions that work? I quote, "We are not all-knowing and all-powerful and cannot become so. We cannot create paradise on earth. We seek to reduce the dangers to life and increase protection for it. We need wisdom to know what we should, or to know what should and can be changed. So what must we do now?" I quote, "Christians should be restless and discontented with the brokenness of our world. God opens for us new possibilities to overcome particular evils and provide a better future. Our hope in God keeps us from falling into the despair, cynicism, and indifference that too often surround the threat to the earth. Our hope is not superficial optimism, easy escapism, or egotistic desire. Instead, we seek hope, expectant assurance, firm conviction, persistent patience." End quote. Let me change directions again and toss out two other ideas. What if recycling is just a middle class phenomenon, a privilege, or a fad? I heard recently that a city in Texas just passed a law prohibiting people from climbing into dumpsters to recover aluminum cans. I thought it was kind of ironic that probably the people who need that money the most are prohibited from getting it and prohibited from recycling. Along the same line, what if you live in an apartment and you don't have room for the recycling bins? Or if you have a house even, but you can't afford the extra $2 a month to get your recyclables picked up at the curb? Are we being inclusive here or exclusive in our goal of recycling? Is that only for certain kinds of people? Is it only for the rich or the politically correct? Second thought, what would happen if recycling was just a way of life, a necessity? Gene Anderson, who's a TV newscaster in the Seattle area, went to China a few years back when it was first opened to Westerners. And in her hotel room one day, she wrote some notes on a piece of paper, used the notes, and then discarded it in the wastebasket. Next day, there it was on the table again. It had been neatly unfolded and the creases smoothed out of it. somebody, the housekeeper, I suppose, had taken the time to recycle it. Because at that time and in that place, paper was too valuable to be thrown away. And I ask you, wouldn't it be nice to live in a society where being frugal or conserving or saving were virtues? Let's go ahead and say it. Let's just being cheap. Wouldn't it be nice to have that be a virtue instead of a sign of a warped personality? To summarize, this really hasn't been intended to be a talk about whether to recycle or not to recycle. What I've tried to convey is a call to examine or re-examine what we're trying to do. Are we achieving the goals that we set out to? Or have we created more problems? And is there any hope, really? Whether it be through technology or societal change? Well, you know the answer. Of course there's hope. This is Holden Village. And speaking of hope, I hope you'll come back tomorrow morning when I recycle, and I emphasize the word recycle, an Advent story by the Reverend Sarah Shear Hansen. In it, she does the impossible task of combining the twin themes of garbage and the coming of our Lord. And with Christmas in July here in Holden just 3 days away, what could be more appropriate? Thank you. So we're open for questions.
What alternative suggestions have you? Obviously, since you're posing a lot of questions, there must be some answers that you have in your mind as improvements. One, of course, you were suggesting that combining waste pickup and recycling in one truck would eliminate the waste from us for two trips. But what? Right now it sounds like a pretty negative presentation on recycling.
And again, I guess I've tried to use legalese and other weasel words to say that there's a more hopeful view, of course, and I had this broken into two sessions. But if we put that aside, and again, I do hope some of you come to listen to the Advent story, because I think it sets our attitude, which is obviously the place, not obviously maybe, but for me it would be the place to start, is with our attitude and our view of recycling and why we're trying to do it. Then to move into answer your question, what would I suggest? I guess the first thing I would say is it's like if you go to a builder or real estate broker and say, what will a 3-bedroom house cost me? Depends on lots and lots and lots of things. I would say one of our most important responsibilities is each of us in our own communities have to be involved in that decision of what's right. What works at Holden Village will probably not work in most places in this country in terms of recycling. I think a number of things people can do are, one, not or resist the temptation to be swayed by emotional appeals for recycling. Okay, that would be the first thing. To examine anything you hear. One thing that's not very popular in this country at all is writing letters. Let me back up. I guess one thing that concerns me is, remember a time when we didn't have pharmaceuticals, aspirin, et cetera, wrapped in multi-layers and childproof locks and plastic wrap and all kinds of things? I think it's a shame that this country, 200 million plus people, are held hostage by one or two or three people or however many people tampered with Tylenol 8, 10, 12 years ago. We have a lot of packaging in this country that is basically there to protect the consumer. I don't know that we can ever go back. Is this helping you in your solution? Possibly, if you look at a pharmaceutical, pills or whatever, it's usually in a bottle, a plastic or a glass bottle inside a cardboard carton. That cardboard carton is probably pristine white bleached cardboard stock. There's no need for that. You'll take that and toss that immediately. You know, you won't be handling it for any length of time. writing letters to pharmaceutical companies, to people who sell products that you buy, might be a way of cutting down on packaging.
Why single out the pharmaceutical houses? They're not the ones that are guilty of the overdone packaging.
Oh, I picked it because it was once I couldn't think of a scare story about Ragu spaghetti sauce or something. It has nothing to do with that.
That's not fair.
Oh, no.
Beside which, those safety seals on most of those designed to protect the contents from tampering, they're not adding the bulk. These great big pieces of carpeting, of cardboard, blister packaging, with the blazing, all that junk on there. The toy industry is a prime example of that.
You know, I don't think he was picking on pharmaceutical.
No, but he spoke. I mean, you've got to be careful. That's the impression that people are getting.
Yeah.
And the same thing with when you said about the apartment house. Okay, apartment dwellers have the right to expect garbage disposal. With proper ordinances, they can expect to have the facilities for recycling. I'm puzzled by your. You obviously have something up your sleeve, saving for tomorrow. But I don't see the point of this. I really don't.
Well, let me go over it again, okay? Because I think I see the point of it, at least part of it. And you correct me again, you know, if I miss something. One of the things that he's saying is that just to go through the process of separation, that is to separate your glasses and your plastics and your aluminum cans and everything, that's not going to really result in the recycling unless you have the other two steps. That is, you have the step, and remember, one of the things that I've talked about is, you know, if you're trying to be energy efficient, if you're trying to do these things, you have these trade-offs. The other step is actually getting the recycling material and bringing it someplace. So you have to be a part of that process. Make sure that that's happening, okay, that it's being picked up. And the third one is to make sure that it's recycled, that there is a plant that is capable of doing the recycling. One of the first things that I thought about when I was thinking about the oil that I mentioned, you drained oil from your car, and if you just let it go into the ditch or something like that, then you can pollute the water table. Okay, so there are places where you can take that oil in the garbage dumps, but you have to go a step further. What do they do with the oil then at that point? Okay, is it really recycled? And I think that's very important.
There are places which re-refine oil.
Right, but isn't that what you're saying?
That's exactly right.
There
has to be a market for it. Again, the case in the newspaper, those people who put it on the curb had the best
intentions,
but there wasn't a market for it. Now, if we take that specific example, what really happened? A lot of paper manufacturers did not have plants in place that could handle recycled paper. In other words, they couldn't de-ink it. When you get the pulp out of a tree, of course, it doesn't have any ink on it. So it's a different process, different equipment than if you take old newspaper and you have to de-ink it, which in itself creates a rather nasty byproduct. Okay, markets are extremely important. And in most places in this world, if you don't have, well, I shouldn't get into economics. I won't even theorize, but I think markets are an extremely important part of this. Let me back up. Was this negative about recycling? I don't feel it was. One of my two central points was it is very difficult to discern what is for the common good. Now we could sit and draw. Let's take a specific example because we have a client that has asked us to do something and it has to do with the one truck, two truck thing. And I hadn't intended to get this specific, but let's think about it. You will take out your aluminum cans, bottles, newspapers, whatever in your community is accepted. If you put things in there that they don't accept in that community, it'll end up right back on your lawn, so you're limited to some extent. Obviously, you can't put everything in there because there's a limit to the size of the truck that they'll pick it up in. Okay. We have a theory, and we're trying to gather data on this, that what it happens is there's always some stuff in the household that doesn't go into a recycling bin. Somebody put out their cigarette in it, so you just toss it in the regular garbage instead of putting the recycling bin. So some of it bypasses the recycling bin. Okay, well, let's say the recyclables go to a material recovery facility as they're done today, and they basically treat clean recyclables that you have source separated and is picked up at your curbside. We have a theory that while you could get 90% of that is usable, say, or some number like that, 80, 90%, and the numbers are hard to come by. But that's 80 or 90% of a small portion. Space for recyclables, every tenant will end up paying for it. And well,
somebody's got to pay for it.
Well, I guess we've used that argument for all kinds of things in this world, good and bad and indifferent, and I guess that emphasizes my point of deciding what is the common good, or whose ox will be gored, or which piece of the pie will I get. Again, back to this other thing, we have a theory that if to allow everybody to participate, you were still allowed to separate all those things, but instead threw it in what we call a blue bag. And that went in the truck, and so you've got green or black or other garbage bags and stuff that's not even in bags going in the garbage truck, as well as the blue bags, and taking them to a plant. Those blue bags, because they're easy to identify, go to one side of the plant, and the recyclables are relatively clean and intact inside those. And those were processed, and the rest of the garbage, if you will, went to the other side of the plant, and some certain part of that was mechanically separated or separated in some other fashion. We believe that when you look at the whole picture, you'll get more recyclables out of that than just taking those curbside. But an important side effect of that is that you'll only have one truck out there. And so in round numbers, you probably have half the fuel use and half the air emissions than you might otherwise. And that's just the theory right now, but I've heard other people talk about that recently. The people in the business, both the haulers, the people that sell recycling equipment, consultants like myself, there are a number of us that are beginning to say, hey, this collection is very, very expensive, and is that the best use of our resources?
Healthy skepticism is something the village is going through right now with this program. I have about 1,500 cubic feet of cardboard and 800 cubic feet of recyclable paper and magazines to send out on the bar for $100. I don't know if it's worth $100. And so it's a really one of them. We're going to send a truck down to the bar, they're going to drive with the recycler, they're going to pick it up, take it off the truck, bring the truck back, and send it back to the bar for $100. But I don't know if that cardboard and that paper is worth $100.
I think what I'm hearing and seeing, and I agree with, is that we are being induced to actually waste in order to put up the appearance of not wasting.
Right. All Carol's saying is a healthy degree of skepticism and what is now a big business.
Or not even skepticism, if I can modify it, but the questioning and seeking and searching. Rick?
It occurs to me, and touched on it a little bit, but I think it's worth saying again, is we spend a lot of time trying to figure out what to do with all our waste, either how to reuse it or how to bury it somewhere. I think we need at least as much time at the other end of the stream with our consumer-oriented society. We've gotten accustomed to having a wide range of choices when we go to the store and having it nicely packaged and attractive and seductive in its packaging. And I don't want to blame any particular company, but we have developed a system over the last 4 decades or so where advertising and packaging and consumption are a strong component of driving our economy. And so there are some lifestyle changes that begin on before it becomes waste, before we make the purchase that need as much talk in the congregations.
Well, I suppose it depends on where you live, but there, you know, the stores where we live, you don't have a choice between products that are packaged and those that are not.
In some ways, I'm seeing that, you know, if you look at the advertising nowadays, there are some companies who are using the motive as a selling point for their products. However, sometimes what they're doing, you might have to watch very closely, because if they're replacing a recyclable plastic container with one of these containers that's made out of layers of plastic and aluminum foil and paper and other such stuff, which is much more difficult to recycle, you may actually be causing more of a problem by buying the container that's supposedly ecological friendly than by buying a recyclable plastic container in the first place.
Let's see, there is one element that I think that we all, that I want to reemphasize, that you've already mentioned, but I want to reemphasize it again, and that is that there's this tension. I mean, what is true now isn't necessarily going to be true in 10 years from now. As the population grows, that is, as you can imagine, as the population grows in your area or wherever it is, your initial evaluation of a particular situation will probably change. And the energetics of it, the mechanics of it, and where you are in terms of the best way to do things is going to change. And so this is a continual process, continual tension that you're going to be involved in. And keep that in mind. You've got to look at this yearly. You know, what is the situation?
I was going to say that in the past we haven't really considered what the effects of, for example, paper plants. I mean, they pollute, and there's been no pollution tax really on people dumping their sulfurous type paper mill waste into the streams. And whereas recycling may make some ink gunk, but at least doesn't pollute the streams like a paper mill does. And recycling paper fiber, particularly the unused paper fiber, is very inexpensive. The other thing is the energy pollution tax. You know, you talk about mining more bauxite, making more aluminum, which takes a very energy rich type of product. It's a lot of energy to make out of bauxite. And we don't tax the pollutants that the power plants put out and stuff like that. So in a different way, you know, what I'm saying is that the intrinsic value of recycling may not be economical because of the way we set our society up. The other comment I'd make is that Holden is a poor example. Because, I mean, we're so isolated here that, I mean, most people don't barge trucks down the lake to get rid of it. That's an unusual situation.
If I can reply just to that one, then I guess part of what I'm trying to stimulate in people is to examine these things. I don't have all the answers. And again, the questions aren't even clear-cut. The goals are not clear-cut. And I think one important thing is that at some point, well, back up. I think we would all agree that our pollution problems are largely population-based, mm-hmm. proportional population.
Amen.
And I don't remember who it was that said it, but a rough translation is, as long as sex is more popular than dying, we're always going to have a population problem. And so, ergo, we will also have a pollution problem. I guess the question in my mind is, at what point do we draw the line or way between choosing people and things, or the environment, if you will, as a particular thing? For instance, if the Persian War had turned out differently and the price of oil had shot up, would we then take a different view about incineration or waste energy? Would we say it's more important to keep people warm and keep the lights on than it is to worry about the air pollution? Not I don't mean just disregard it, but we would be trying to make a difficult judgment about people and maybe what are more basic needs. I think that's an important debate.
Well, your basic problem about population is, of course, that's the root cause of all of our problems in society, practically. I mean, what's happened in 72 years when the population of the United States doubles? We have twice as many. We can recycle half the stuff we have today, and it's right back again in 72 years. That's the present rate of growth in the United States. The world is about 30 years, something like that.
And I can't deal with big numbers, but I...
That's not really 30 years is not very big at all.
I think your questioning of these processes that happen with recycling, you know, what it's good to separate and get them within, you know, where's the market? I think those are good questions, but I think it scared me because what it told me was, well, maybe it's better to put it into a landfill and let's not worry about recycling until the market's come. And I'm skeptic of that because I feel that it's like the market's waiting for a supply, and you can't get rid of your supply because there isn't a market, and you got to start somewhere to start this process rolling. And I think, irregardless of whether you got to pay to ship your stuff out, or whether it's curbside or whatever, I think just the process of getting people to separate is a more efficient way of processing these resources. Even if they do end up in the landfill, initially, the transition is a time of big economic turmoil. You know, people losing money, people changing their habits, and it's not an easy task. But I think in order to stimulate this transition period, rather than just sit back and wait for the market to, you know, wait until it's too expensive to put it into a landfill, and then the market, you know, it's more profitable to recycle newsprint, and so they make deinking plants, more deinking plants to take care of that. I don't know. I think it's just as valid to get people to start separating now so that when we do have the deinking plants, you know, the process is already there.
But I didn't hear him saying that entirely. What I heard him saying is that yeah, you do that, but also put pressure on the other processes. Get the transportation in there, make it efficient, and make sure that the recycling plants are being built, and don't tell people that, okay, you don't want a recycling plant near you. That you've got to be putting pressure on all three things, not just one of them.
Okay, and I guess that's my point, is that message was not clear.
Okay.
If that's what you're saying, I totally agree with you, is that we don't need, not only need that, but we do need the pressure on these other things.
Okay, my purpose beyond this, and I guess I did want to evoke a reaction, hostile or otherwise, is because I think it's important for us to think about it. This is not, is what we may think about this church and society. These are very difficult and deep questions. This is not a very clear-cut sort of thing. The operative word in your first sentence was better. What is better? Better has to do with knowing what's good, better, best. What is right? What is desirable? And I can't judge that for anybody but myself. And since I'm only one person, you know, I didn't come here to tell you that when I was in grad school, I put everything on the back of a bicycle and rode a couple of miles with it. That's not the point, to show me as an example. And yet each of us has that choice every day to do something like that. And whether out of necessity or out of desire, whether out of our feeling that that's our duty or our responsibility as Christians or whatever reason, I just ask that we think about it. I say market stimulation because it's something that most, how many people have written to a senator or representative in the last year? And this is probably 10 times as many as in the general population. It looks to me like roughly 6, 8, 10% of the group here.
Terrell, that's I would like to make a comment and thank you very, very much for the presentation that you have given. I will, tomorrow evening at the same time, I will be giving a the first part of two lectures on municipal solid waste. You'll get a slightly different slant on it.
Good. You haven't spoken at all about dangerous medical waste and things like that. I mean, you assume that all garbage that's being generated is the packaging on bread or something, it seems to me.
Oh, no.
I mean, what would you just dump those all in landfill, Stephen?
No, actually, that's, I'm glad you brought that up. And I know it's because you're from Minnesota and you know I'm working on a project for the Mayo Clinic.
Well,
thank you.
I think that's why.
We could talk about each of these areas for hours. And so it wasn't a malicious means of... there's many types of wastes as you would like to give time to talk about. Let's take medical waste just for an instant, though. How's medical waste handled in this country? First, we have a hard time defining it. Center for Disease Control in Atlanta doesn't agree with EPA, which doesn't agree with most state and local health departments, is what is infectious waste? What we call in generic terms red bag waste. There's medical waste or waste from hospitals. A lot of it looks like what's in the garbage cans at here, around here at your home, in the kitchen, that sort of thing. But if we took just what's supposedly red bag or infectious waste, just looked at that, there are two technologies that are approved, if you will, or recommended by EPA universally for this type of waste, and that's incineration and steam sterilization. If you say incineration in a lot of places, you need to duck for cover because people don't want it burned. And so you say, well, what should I do? Well, I don't know, but just take care of it. The first thing you learn in the solid waste business is that most people just want it to go away. They want to put the can out there, and when they come back, come home at night, the can's empty. People want it to go away. I personally have some concern about steam sterilization. I'm not convinced that it actually sterilizes the waste in the middle of the plastic bag that's in the middle of the pile that's stuck in the steam sterilizer. There are other new technologies being marketed now. They don't have much of a track record. I think we ought to keep testing them, investigating them, and somebody ought to install some of them and try them out. But to my way of thinking, I think incineration is the only true safe way. And I mean by that properly done incineration with new air pollution equipment, not something that we had 10 years ago. I don't think medical waste should go directly to landfills. Absolutely not.
Well, you know, one of the things about medical waste that people don't normally put that into perspective either, those medical wastes all came from someone who is probably right in your community at some point in time, already infectious, whether it's hepatitis or, you know, some serious flu strain or whatever. But it's come from someone who's already been in your community and is far more of an exposure to you than that medical waste in a landfill ever would be.
But the point is, you can't control that person, but you can control the byproducts of dealing with that person. And if you don't control those to the best of your ability, then you're guilty of negligence. The thing that concerns me is what you just said, that most people want to put the can out there and have it go away. But that's basically what I hear you advocating. We have no shortage of landfill space, therefore, let's forget about the recycling, because recycling really is not a cost-efficient method of dealing with the problem. Let's dump it all in the landfill, and we have regressed back to that mentality then of let's just put it out and forget about it. When we have people now who at least have gotten to the point of being sensitized to the problem, of the point of agreeing to separate. Maybe this isn't the best, and I realize that we have a lot of work to do controlling the source of all of this garbage, which is the best place to attack any problem. But let's not say, okay, let's dump this simply because it's not the best at this point.
No, you misinterpret what I said.
Well, that's what came across to me.
My words were, there is no actual shortage of landfill space in this country. Mm-hmm. the end, I don't believe the end justifies the means. And telling somebody that there is a shortage of landfill space in this country would be, that would be incorrect. That would be false. That is not a true statement. There is a politically activated shortage, or triggered shortage, if you will, but there is no shortage of land, period, in this country. There is no shortage of geologically suitable, transportation suitable, engineering, from an engineering standpoint, land suitable for building landfills. And the fact is, whether we like it or not, landfilling still is the least, even and especially responsible, to the best of our knowledge, technically today. Landfilling is still, in most cases, the cheapest alternative. Now, you notice I have never once said tonight, cost is the most important factor. It is just a factor. And to say that cost is of no object goes back to my point about, I do really ask whether recycling is, in fact, a middle and upper class phenomenon. Whether people who are not so well off financially can afford to recycle. The marginal cost may mean nothing to you or me, $2 a month, but it may mean something to somebody else. And again, that's the whole sort of thought process that I wanted to trigger, that common good, what may be good for you, me, and most of the people in this room, may not be good for everybody.
Well, doesn't necessarily mean, you know, we shouldn't do it. If we expect people to pay for recycling when we're not paying for other things, I think that's improper. You know, I grew up in a socialist Milwaukee where everything was taken care of and it doesn't matter what it is. And if some people can't afford to recycle, then the government should pay for recycling, or the rest of us shouldn't be left to people's choice as to whether they financially, as to whether they recycle.
Do we have parallel models in other things like medical care, and to what extent?
Yeah, we do, some extent, everything.
I guess I would agree with your analysis that we don't have a shortage of landfill space. I think that's totally true. But to say that it's still the least costly way of disposing it, I guess I'm having a hard time when I hear so many municipalities who have looked for landfill spaces and have not been able to find an area, whether it's political or cost or whatever the reason. You know, I think there is a cost that is keeping us from finding those landfill spaces. And I feel like I'm getting two different, you're saying it doesn't cost anymore. And well, then if it's inexpensive, then why are we having trouble finding these places?
Our nosy neighbors.
That's a cost, though. Yeah. I mean, let's be real.
Do you have a landfill next to you? Do you?
I'm a paid-up, card-carrying NIMBY.
That's right. We all are.
That's fine, but what I'm saying is that's a legitimate cost.
Which is?
This NIMBY phenomenon, an economic cost, and to say that it's still cheaper to landfill it, I think, I'm not convinced.
Yeah, but wait a minute.
Okay, let me try to separate the questions. There are a number of questions there. You're saying, why are cities having problems? Do you think it's because, for instance, can you say you've read a report that says, my God, we looked at every square foot of land in this state, city, county, and couldn't find it. Yes, you could say in New York City there is no landfill space, and I would agree with you.
That's one of the places I'm
okay. Why is Seattle going to Oregon?
That's pretty expensive energy-wise, isn't it? Transport that all the way over there?
Well, let's talk about that, because that's a semi-myth. And it's being hauled by rail.
Rail isn't expensive, and
is
very efficient.
Rail is a very efficient way of transporting heavy goods.
Yeah.
And I happen to think it's safer than many ways in terms of accidents per ton mile of goods carried. Right. That's what makes that move cheaper. What are some other reasons why it's cheaper? Because they don't get much rainfall there. And if we're concerned about leachate, which most of us are, that's one of the primary bugaboos, it's hard to make leachate without rain, since they don't really hose down the garbage when it goes in. And if it's a desert condition, then you will generate relatively little leachate. Now, why? Let me give you some background on people in Gillum County. Gillum County is eastern Oregon. It's got a low population. There aren't a whole lot of jobs. And the company that put in that landfill went through a lot of effort to talk to those people, to reassure them, to give them guarantees that they were going to make sure it was safe. They offered them jobs. They offered them host fees. I assume they paid taxes of some sort or another. All those things helped to make the people support it. Part of the cost in siting the landfill, a lot of it, especially if you're unsuccessful, is all the permitting, the public meetings, that whole thing of starting over again when the first site is rejected. I don't know if you asked a number of questions, and I'm not sure that I...
No, my main point was that if cost isn't a problem, which seems to be your assertion...
No, I didn't say it wasn't a problem. I said it is less landfill, in general, is less expensive. And if you were to put out a bid tomorrow to take garbage from City X, and you said, we don't care whether you take it to a materials recovery facility or a landfill or incinerator or whatever, I think you would find out that landfilling probably comes in cheapest.
A number of us in the room are educators, and we work with kids on environmental studies and so forth. So I mean, we're almost done here. What's the bottom line then? What are we supposed to tell kids? Are we supposed to say, because they have to be explained, they don't understand the complexities. And really, that's where our values are formed about what to do. And I'm really confused about, like, for myself, I plan on being a garbologist. It's an experience that I'd like to share with people. But well, what am I going to tell my class then? If you could just help me out on that.
I wish I could. I don't know. Let's see if we can work through that tomorrow, because it deserves, you're absolutely correct. It's an important question. I just don't have the answer.
I just wouldn't want anyone in this presentation to think that recycling is not working now. In Oregon, recycling is working now. The best way to speak is from your own experience. And recycling, because the people in Oregon, in Portland, are so good at sorting their garbage, it was chosen as a site to build a new paper de-inking plant and different things like that. And we just had our session with the State Assembly, and they passed new laws requiring a certain amount of markets. So almost everything that you said that was the negative side of it is being taken care of. And it's good that we hear all this, but it's been such a short time that people have started recycling and sorting in their own homes. I mean, we're doing really, really good. Really good. And I just wouldn't want anyone here to think that it's not working.
And
because it's already working.
You're providing the landfill for a large portion of Washington.
Yeah, we're doing a good enough job. We'll take Seattle's garbage. I mean, it's no big deal. But I appreciate a lot of the points that you make, and people really do need to work through all the three things, those loops. And recycling is just is a really small part in this whole environmental thing.
I want, just 1 second, just to say that I thought it was interesting that the state had to mandate markets.
Well, that's not that, this is America, and where there's a lot of easy bucks to be made.
One comment to what we can tell our kids as far as those that are in teaching. Terrell's reason for bringing up the pharmaceutical company, fear of raising an inspector again, but that box that your Tylenol or whatever comes in is bleached paper. Now, they could make that out of unbleached paper just as easily, and it would have no adverse effect on the package or on the product. It's just the box would be brown tone instead of bleached white. So what the kids can do is, and adults too, is to write the companies and say, why don't you make your boxes out of unbleached paper?
Or not use a box at all. It's just a
shop. Yeah, or figure out a way of, well, I think transporting and packaging is a lot easier with a box. Small things like that, and that will then create some of the markets for the recycled or unbleached or other. And also to look on your products to see that instead of saying recyclable, it says recycled. And that's a real buzzword in the industry for packaging, is they're putting recyclable. That doesn't mean a darn thing. It means that they use new product to make their product, and then they, you can throw it in a recycling bin, and it can be recycled, but it hasn't been recycled. So you're not creating the third part of that loop to close the loop up and to buy the recycled products. So look for something that says recycled instead of recyclable.
And if it gives its percentage of post-consumer waste, that's the best.
I kind of got a two-part question that relates to landfills. Number one, that are there any feasibility studies or any as to doing any recovery on some of the old landfills? Also, are any of the landfills that are being designed now, are they taking into account any possibility of reusing or recycling any of the material or recovering any of the materials later on?
I hear occasionally about people talking about mining landfills. You probably have heard of Professor William Rathjay of University of Arizona, I think, or Arizona State, who is an anthropologist that takes his students out and they...
See the Geographic article?
Yes, yes. And he's dug through landfills, and one of the things they find is that biodegradability has very little to do with what actually happens in a landfill. The stuff is there, it's intact. So we might want to think of them as long-term repositories.